Square Talks. Unser Podcast mit den Personalities und Artists in Residence.
So welcome, Professor Rogers, to our little podcast episode here as our personality in residence at the Square at University of St. Gallen. With me today is also Tim Kramer, the intendant of the Square, and we just want to get to know you a little better, want to understand what brought you to St. Gallen and what you experienced during this day and what you expect for the next day. So you are a pioneer in the field of computer, a human-computer interaction, and are considered as one of the founders of the, and now this word is really difficult for me, ubiquitous computing. It's even hard in German. So was this the reason why you were named as an honorary doctor or professor at our university?
Thank you very much for that introduction. I think it's not for me to say why I was chosen. I think it's up to the people in the newly formed computer science department. And they wanted to choose someone to be their first honorary doctorate. So that's where they went through that selection process. And I don't know how many they considered, but someone who was hired in the computer science department, Professor Johannes Schöning, I think, put forward my name, and I came and gave a presentation and talked to people so that they kind of got a sense of who I was. And then it was behind closed doors, I believe, as the process by which they decided on who should be their honorary doctorate. So that's how I came here. And I remember it very well because it was pouring with rain. And we waited for it to stop raining, but it didn't stop raining. And we eventually came into the hall and, there was the ceremony. And I got to meet quite a few people. And it was a very nice occasion. So that's what's behind.
Oh, wonderful. So you must have feel at home when it was pouring while you got this beautiful announcement, no?
I feel more at home today when it was cloudy and grey and then it became sunny, which is sometimes what happens in London.
Very, very great. Yeah, wonderful. Now, so our Department of Computer Science is brand new still, although it's already 5 years old, they told us today. So they started 5 years ago, but they made quite some progress, and it was a hard journey to, grow up at the business school. Did you observe a little bit of that? Is it different from what you experience at other universities with long-standing computer science programs?
I think I've had first-hand experience of starting up a new computer science department. I was in the Midwest in the U.S., in a university called University of Indiana, Bloomington, and they were setting up a brand new school of informatics. And it was in its second year when I joined. And in 1 year, they hired 24 new faculty, and I was heavily involved. I think every day we had lunch or breakfast with candidates. So I've had that experience of trying to build something very quickly. And some of the problems are that you're trying to keep track of all the different people that you're trying to hire. So I think here in St. Gallen, they've done it a bit more slowly rather than trying to hire 20 people in 1 year, because that is quite a challenge. And you get teething problems, and you get fatigue because there's only so many breakfasts and free lunches that you want. But I think they've been, very successful here in trying to think about what are the areas that complement the other disciplines and subjects that are studied here. So I don't actually know full details about it, but I know when Johannes was hired, Professor Schöning, he thought a lot about what areas to build and develop. And obviously, thinking of my own area, human-computer interaction, it's very much an area that is growing and expanding. So that was one.
Yeah, why do you think this was so important for Johannes Schöning, this whole field? Why is it so important for us? Why should we have a closer look at your discipline?
Sabine, okay.
Thank you.
I think It's important. It's a growing area, and nearly every university has a master's or offers PhDs in human-computer interaction. So it would be remiss of St. Gallen when they starting a computer science department not to think about the human side of technology and to just think about the the programming or the technical side. So that's why I think it's so important, and that's why I think St. Gallen hired Johannes to kind of build that side up.
Wonderful. What was your connection to the field, Tim? Did you know a whole lot about human-computer interaction besides our famous movie series?
Yeah, we started a movie series in our new building square about artificial intelligence. We started, of course, with 2001 Odyssey. And I mean, this is the only, because he said human-computer interaction, what is the idea about it? What is your standing at the moment at your science? Where do you, what do you think about at the moment with this kind of AI revolution, isn't it? I mean, it is something.
Absolutely. I think there's been a big move in AI towards autonomy and efficiency to try and, do things faster and perhaps without humans being there. Mm-hmm. And there are some tasks where it's proven you can have robots and AI working in tandem and replacing the human. But there are many, many tasks and activities where the human is central to them, whether it's learning, whether it's decision making, problem solving, and where you still need the human. And I think that's where human-centered AI comes into it. We can design AI to replace or to be autonomous in, like self-driving cars. But actually, what's proven more effective is to think about how we use the AI to augment the human driver or the human being. So that's where we stand today in, thinking about human-centered technology is, how do we design it to augment and empower people? Mm-hmm. And I think it's still really important to think about that rather than let's just design technology to replace people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. And the whole building square and the ideas about new ways of learning. So my question is always when you talked about how we should think about AI, but on the other hand, should humans learn different things for the future to deal with the AI?
Absolutely. I think we should have a really big rethink about what we teach our students and also younger kids to prepare them for the future. And so how do they embrace and engage with AI rather than us saying you can't use it? And then how do we learn? I mean, how do we teach and how do we assess our students? And I think all of these need to be rethought. And I think now that it's so easy for ChatGPT and other tools to be used to write essays and plans and code, we need to think, well, if that's the case, let's think about how else we can encourage students to learn with these tools. So one of the things I've been thinking about is how we might help them to with public speaking or with explaining verbally. And most students are terrified of having to talk to their professor or someone else about what they've just learned. So we're thinking about how we can help them to train to be better speakers and better communicators verbally, not just writing essays. Mm-hmm. And we could have a virtual environment where there are AI avatars and maybe real human beings who help them to practice and to train. And that's one of the things we're looking at. So that's one example of where we might change how we teach our students and what skills, new skills we equip them with.
Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting. Do you think those are kind of old school skills that are now more important than they were before because the AI give us so much support in other things?
Yes, I think some of those skills might have been superseded by the move towards teaching our kids, our students to program or to to write, and maybe the power of speaking is something that we could return to, and that if we can make or help our the next generation become better communicators. I think that could be a very effective thing to do. But we also, there are other skills as well which we need to think about. How do we, you know, if they've got these tools, how does it help them to be more creative? How does it help them to brainstorm? How does it help them to solve problems? And not to always be thinking, how do I get the AI to do it for me?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. How do I get the good grade? Because there is no free lunch. Also, with all the AI available, it needs to be your own pride. You want to achieve something. You want to learn something. That's what we still need to get this fire in our students, that they really want to learn something and evolve during their studies. That will be very important. And I'm very glad that you also highlight the human in the loop. So there is not a replacement that we want to have with AI. It's more the enhancement of our capabilities, which is great, especially for students with dyslexia, for example. For them, it's much easier to get an access to written materials, to interact with materials, because they can just freely talk, which is easier for them than reading and, you know, understanding everything in detail. So I like that. And I see my children, they are very used to voice messages and everything. I'm still trying to type with my very slow fingers. But I think that's a very interesting idea to have them talk more often to their artificial sidekick and hopefully get some ease in talking in public.
Absolutely. And also to listen, you know, so the art of listening and then thinking about what to say and having that conversation. So I think that is a skill that some students have, you know, perhaps it's been overlooked, or because of COVID there wasn't maybe the opportunity. So now let's think about how we use these tools to help students develop conversational skills.
Absolutely. So that's your turf then again, conversational skills.
Absolutely. So for me, it's so interesting that from your point of view, it's also kind of the old skills, which a little bit, like you said, like maybe in COVID or somewhere it lost. This is also what I get from the students, kind of that they have really a gap there in their skills. In our little movie series, that always the question is, how long will it take that the machines can act like humans? what is the pro saying to this question? Or is this a stupid question? Maybe.
No,
this is always in the human.
It's a science fiction question.
Yeah,
we always wonder when will the machine be perfect, and when will it be human? Yeah. It will never be human, no?
I think it's fascinated us that we can build machines that can imitate some of our human qualities, and that's been something going back in history, automata, and then some of the first AI programs from 50, 60 years ago where they were trying to mimic conversations with psychotherapist, I think it was Eliza. So it's only natural for us to be fascinated with how far can we go in trying to imitate using machines ourselves. And you see that with robotics as well. How can we make robotics seem more human-like? So I think there's a difference between artificial intelligence and human intelligence. In human intelligence, we have emotional intelligence. We have all sorts of other aspects and experiences which we use when we're interacting with others. I think many of the tests that have been developed to try and see whether artificial intelligence is similar to human are quite constrained in what they test. So maybe it's not a misplaced question, but it's a difficult one to answer. And I think, you know, how is AI evolving as it becomes smarter is perhaps a more interesting question. And what are the human qualities that will remain human? But of course, some of the skills that artificial intelligence will develop will exceed human's ability. And they do that with computation already.
But yeah, absolutely.
But whether they can start to become so human-like that it becomes a bit, you know, uncanny, as the phrase is. That's an open question.
And in my course, when we start, they all students, the first thing they do is they put up their laptops. And in my course, I always say at the beginning, oh, laptops back in your cases, you know, forget the cases. But this is a big question here in Switzerland, also in Germany, Austria, and the German-speaking world, is how in teaching-wise, do young people need to get used to their machines, or is it better to say in the first 4 years to put all the phones outside the classrooms? This is the discussion at the moment here.
Yeah, it's a big discussion worldwide, and you know, in Australia they banned smartphones for until they're 16 years old. And you know, is there something about when you're 16, you're ready to deal with all of the challenges of using all the different apps and social media? I don't know. I think it's not a either or. I think phones and tablets and laptops have, you know, many applications that can help students learn. Just using Google search to discover things. There are many drawing applications and painting and designing, and I think there's some great applications for getting kids to learn problem solving. So there's lots of things you can do with computers that can help kids to learn. I think the problem has been that they've been exploited and used by unpleasant, nefarious people who will use social media platforms that were intended for, you know, good social interactions. And I think probably one of the first was Second Life. And where, you know, paedophile rings started to use them. And so it's natural for parents to be really worried and teachers about what might happen if they have full access to what's on the internet, and also with AI now. And it's not an easy one. And I think you can kind of go halfway by, during the breaks, maybe they can use their phones or their laptops during class time, but when it's during breaks, they should be banned. But the practicalities of trying to take the phone away and at different times may be, you know, too difficult. So I think we have to come to some sort of compromise and think about what might be the controls and the safeguards we can put in place when using these devices. But the trouble is, as soon as you ban them, you know, kids can't wait to get a hold of them after school. And is that, you know, when, and some of their friends will have them. So I think it's a really tricky one, and there's no easy, you know, one solution.
Absolutely. I must confess, I was fascinated. I just, only recently I read an article about the new charter school in the US, and I think it was Nevada or Utah, where they finally got permission to have a full school operating just with AI. So every student would have a very individualized learning path where they learn with what they need at the moment, and they have great progress and they actually learn really well if it's well curated and if the prompts are okay. And on the other hand, they still have professors which are professors in social interaction. So they go outside with them, they make a fire, they dance outside, they kind of engage in playfulness. And I think, maybe this could also be an approach. So it's not the tech that is bad, it's how people use it. So the tech is neutral, but we have to think about what other measurements do we need to make it beneficial for education and for our youth? Could you agree with that?
Absolutely. It sounds wonderful. And, you know, if there could be more schools that could, you know, learn from their experiences. And, you know, is it a small school? Is it a private school? Is it well-funded? Is it got, you know? And so I think there are examples of schools where they have good practice and, you know, the kids are well-rounded in their education and their social skills. But I suspect that these are few and far between. And so it's good to see and hear that, and maybe lessons can be learned as to how, you know, some of those can be put into practice more, you know, wide scale.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I'm always curious about is this, because the school is close to it's a business university, isn't it? So it's always when we talk about AI and computer science and all this, I always have in my mind the data business with it. Like, I always forget it, but sometimes then when I hear something other people's talking about, it's always how it's such a big business, the data, and how can we deal with this in the future? Is this, I think it's really problematic for me.
It is problematic, and I think we have in the UK, and I'm sure in other countries, a big move towards what's called responsible AI, mm-hmm. where there are committees and experts looking at what's the safest way by which to manage the data that's needed and trained. So there are people trying to look into that as to how that process can be managed. Mm. And there's always been a problem with data, big data and small data. Is it sold on, what happens to it, where is it stored? And I think that's for people who work in data science to provide, different methods by which to safeguard and protect people's data. Particularly in healthcare, I think that's mm-hmm. where a lot of data can be collected. Mm-hmm. But there's going to be more data that's available from, all the learning that students have done. If we're going to use that to monitor and track and personalize their lessons. So it's a really important question. There is a sea of data out there. How does someone else make sense of it? How do they use that data is our questions that need to be answered.
Do you think the European way to be more restrict with the data is the right way, or do you lean more on the like the US way, where you have not so much restrictions in this?
I think GDPR has been, since it came out 10 years ago or something, mm-hmm. been successful at helping to protect. I think in the AI, maybe some of it's a bit strict in terms of the rules and regulations that have been put into place, in terms of it might curtail some innovation for new products. But, you have to try and get the right balance between protecting people and enabling new innovations.
And also to build trust in the general public, because only then we can have good progress in innovation as well, because otherwise it's going to be hard. I had to look it up real quick. So you have this wonderful project, Minds, Media and Machines, where you work with medical data as well. How was that? How did that work, easily, or was it hard for you?
I don't remember which one you're
talking
about.
That was the University of Bremen. So it's not generated by ChatGPT. Okay. It's real.
Sorry, it's since been renamed. Yes, so I was invited about 2019 to be a chair of excellence at the University of Bremen. And we came up with a theme. Basically, this provided some funding for collaboration between UCL and Bremen, and for my expertise to help researchers at University of Bremen to think about how to set up a lab. And so that was the topic. But we actually moved into digital healthcare. And so the PhD students and postdocs that worked there worked on those themes. So that was kind of like a high level.
So it was like an umbrella.
Yes.
Okay. So you got to learn, or you met people at the University of Bremen. You met people all around the world, in the US, in the UK. So how is it to meet some Swiss people? Are we different? What is different here at the University of St. Gallen if you compare us to other institutions?
Well, that's a bit like comparing apples and oranges. There are certain, qualities or differences. So I have had a PhD student who's Swiss, and he's very reserved, but, very thoughtful, very caring. And unlike, say, my Italian, if we're allowed a bit of a stereotype, who's much more outgoing. But I think overall, my experience of people here at St. Gallen is that they're incredibly professional and thoughtful, and thinking about how they can use technology. The students are very earnest and hardworking and thinking very much about, coming here, how will that help them in the future? So just looking at the students here, they seem less, they seem very studious, I would put it.
Oh, yeah. Hardworking, one could say.
And I can say, the faculty I've met have been really kind and collegiate and sociable. And, I have nothing more other than positive things to say about my experiences.
Yeah, and we, of course, have to talk about the square. And do you think that a building just like Square or a concept like Square could help us in the future to better understand how humans interact, how we can make best use of technology and all that? What is ahead of us?
My first experience of coming to the Square was when I first came here, and I was just bowled over at the architecture, but also the way in which it was used by students, faculty, and visitors. And it's just amazing, just the vibe. Even today, it's just all floor, something else is happening. And just seeing the posters, and I wasn't quite sure that seeing myself being blasted up on the display, it's a bit disconcerting.
The price you pay for personality in residence.
But I think it's a wonderful space, and I think it will be the envy of many universities to have such a space, and the openness and the, that it's for everyone. And I only heard today one complaint from a student who said that sometimes it's a bit noisy and what a pity. But other than that, it just walking around and just hearing, bumping into people. So I think it's a wonderful, institution or a concept that other universities could learn from as to how to bring students and staff together and to have that water cooler moment times thousand, and I think it's seems to be innovating still and thinking very much about how to keep that, but what can happen in the next few years for this type of space.
And this happens in Switzerland, where we are super organized. So we try to have this openness there. Do you think this works well, like computer science, within the Square boundaries?
I mean, there's room to progress. It's not, but I think it's really a success story, a story of success for us. The whole idea of informal learning, I think, is very important for the future, and this is what we kind of like to create in the Square. To have those serendipity moments and somebody's running into Yvonne Rogers and thinking about first time about human AI or machine interaction. So thank you very much for your visit at our space.
That's wonderful. I have one personal question at the end. You have like this super impressive career in science and research. How did that happen? Is there any like magic moment where you knew exactly where to go and what to do? And
absolutely not. I didn't think I was going to be an academic. I fell into it. I was going to work in industry. It's always serendipitous. Sometimes it's been tragedy that's caused me to change direction. So my partner died suddenly when he was young. So that caused me to up sticks and go to the States. And then I realized I didn't like it there and I came back. So and then I meet people and I spark off ideas. But I think one of the things I've gotten people always say about me is, I inspire people, and inspiration is key, I think, to whether I'm just talking to a student who's feeling down in the dumps, or inspiring them to go off and think, yes, I can do that, or inspiring, today, getting them to think in the class what's possible with AI and how to, think about the future. So that probably is, my secret is curiosity and inspiration.
That's how great. Wonderful, yeah. Isn't it? Thank you for talking with us. And this was an inspiration for me already. It was lovely to listen to you because I didn't know you before, and it's just wonderful. And thank you to Tim, because this program, Personality in Residence, is just something that really is magic and sparks curiosity and friendship as well.
And thank you for inviting me here.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.